Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello, and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine Human Performance Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and we're so glad that you took the time to download us and that you're taking the time to listen. We, every week, strive to bring you another interesting person in the world of sports medicine, human performance, general health, and general physical education a lot of times. And today is no exception. We are pleased to have Dr. Laurie Priest with us today. Welcome to the podcast, Laurie.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tim.
Well, we're so glad to have you. Let me give the audience a little bit of an introduction, and okay, we'll tell them why you're here. We are so glad to have Laurie with us today. She originally has a master's degree in exercise physiology from the University of Maryland at College Park. For many years, she was in athletic administration and was chair of physical education. For 24 of those years, she was at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. She has a large number of honors for her service during those years. For example, she served on the NCAA Women's Committee from 1991 to 94. She was the president of the National Association for Girls and Women in Sport from 89 to 90. She has won many awards along with that. In 2002, she was named the Division III Athletic Administrator of the Year by the National Association for Collegiate Women Athletic Administrators. And she currently serves on the Board of Governors and for AFRED, the American Alliance of Health, Physical Education, Recreation, and Dance, which is changing its name, which we'll talk about in a minute, and currently serves as a chair of the Social Justice Committee for that organization, which is about to be known as the Society of Health and Physical Educators, right? Or SHAPE America.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's interesting when one of the larger professional organizations decides to change its name.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, I'm not currently serving on the board. I did serve on the Board of Governors, so, you know, but just
still a big
FYI.
Deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal.
That is a big deal. So you're here today because we have a conference and here on campus about atmosphere and climate, and you're here to talk in particular. One of your research interests is about gender equity in sport, and so we're glad to have you.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
You're welcome. So where did your passion for women's equality in sport come from? What is the journey? That's what we ask a lot of our guests.
Well, for me, I think it came from a young female who back in the late 60s, early 70s, didn't have opportunities to participate in sport. Mm-hmm. You know, when I graduated from high school or went to high school, I had two brothers who played sports in high school, and there were no sports for girls. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio area, and I was active and involved and in sports, but there were no teams for me overall, so I was very frustrated by that. But when I graduated in 1973 from high school and went to college, mm-hmm, Title IX had just been passed in 1972, and opportunities were starting to grow for women. And so I participated in intercollegiate athletics at the Division III level. I played volleyball, basketball, and softball there. And
multi-sport athlete.
Yeah, it was in the day when you could have a multi-sport athlete, even at Division III, which is tough these days. But what I did see was women did not have the same opportunities as the men. Even with, you know, even though participation opportunities were added, we weren't supported with transportation, the coaching, those kinds of things overall. So I wanted more. I wanted to see it be better. And so I was planning to go into the profession anyway. And so I always wanted to teach, coach, and eventually be an athletic director. And so that really started my journey. And that's where my advocacy came from, really wanting to provide opportunities for girls, but also broad-based opportunities for boys and men as well, in sport, to provide an educational model of sport.
Now, Mount Holyoke has primarily a women's institute.
It's all women, yes. It's an all-women's college.
And so did, in those types of institutions, did you see with the passage of Title IX, did you see the increase in athletics programs there, or were those already kind of established in those types of institutions?
Well, some of the first athletic programs for women started at the women's colleges, you know, Wellesley, Vassar, Mount Holyoke overall. It's where participation opportunities were, but they were really not that competitive overall. In fact, many of the original physical educators didn't, women physical educators didn't support competition.
Really?
No. There was a small group that did, but many looked at it more as a social aspect overall, didn't want it to become too competitive for women because they were concerned about the impact on those women in many, many ways. But as it began to develop overall, you know, women were coming into colleges and wanted mm-hmm. those opportunities. Mm-hmm. So those programs grew and developed. And then we know when, you know, originally programs were organized and overseen by the Association for Intercollegiate Athletics for Women. Up until, that was the initial governing body, up until 1982 when the NCAA said, wait a minute, Title IX's been out there for 10 years. Women's sports are growing. They're not going to go away. And at that point, the NCAA, which had had no interest in women's athletics, said, wait a minute, we're going to take you under our wing and we are going to oversee and govern women's sports. So that's when the takeover, as we call it, sure. occurred overall. And then women's sports were housed then under the NCAA overall.
So, but that was an interesting time period that I do remember to some extent, and that it was like a switch was flipped. It was almost overnight NCAA said, wait a minute, we want to get into this ball game as well. And as you said, the takeover happened. I mean, I was at Tennessee during that time, mm-hmm. and we watched especially the women's basketball. Suddenly then became an NCAA
right.
institution for women athletics. Was it a controversial takeover? Or?
Oh, it was, because the AIW, they wanted to continue to manage and run in mm-hmm. women's intercollegiate athletics overall. And so, but the NCAA saw, they offered schools incentives to no additional fees or dues to mm-hmm. bring your women's program underneath it. And it was really in the beginning. You know, I try when I teach a college athletics course at UMass Amherst in their sport management program, when I talk to my students about the history, you know, these students, all they've ever known is the NCAA.
Right, right.
And the NCAA has done many good things in more recent years, I would say, overall. But initially, the goal was to, if we can't stop women's athletics then from growing, then let's control them overall and bring them under our, you know, under our direction. You know, one of the most interesting things for me career-wise was before I went to Mount Holyoke, I was at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia, and we were a women's institution, but we went co-ed in the early 80s. And so as an athletic director there, I had the opportunity to implement Title IX in reverse in some way mm-hmm. because we were bringing young men into our institution. And many of my colleagues said to me that you know, make it tough on these guys like it's been for the women overall. And I said, I can't. I'm a sport educator. You know, we need to provide equal opportunities for our men and our women overall. But at that same time, I was in the state of Virginia. Some of my colleagues, some of the male athletic directors that I worked with, and most of them were male at the time, kept saying, I just don't understand this Title IX. What do these girls want? And I said, well, they want you know, a good coach, they want uniforms, they want transportation, they want the same opportunities that the men want overall. And so I really used it as an opportunity to establish a program that was fully gender equitable as we got established. And one of the most interesting things that came out of it, Tim, was that the young men in our program that I got to know overall, we had created a program that was a level playing field. And as I talk with some of our young male athletes, they'd say, you know, it's just not fair. Our program's not fair. And I'd say, what's not fair? You've got equal facilities. We flip-flop game times. We flip-flop practices. You have same access to the trainer. Well, they were used to coming from high schools where they were on the upper rung of the ladder, mm-hmm. and they were privileged. Mm-hmm. And so when it was equal for them, it was seen as less than mm-hmm. overall. But it provided a great teachable moment and an opportunity to really talk about that and look at where we'd been and where we were going.
You know, while Title IX has been lauded has been so important in the development of sport, especially for women, there's still bad things associated with Title IX because some universities have chosen to cut men's sports. And so the athletes in those men's sports say, well, wait a minute, this is not fair for us because we're losing our sport. Would you comment on that for
Well,
us?
I would say to you that in the last 10 years, for every new dollar spent on women's sports, $3 have been spent on men's sports.
So it's still inequitable.
And basically, when we look at the data from 2000 to 2011, there were 44,000 new sport opportunities offered for men, and men are less than by about less than 100 sport opportunities. Mm-hmm. So they've grown. And I've got all the data and statistics. Sure. I crunch these numbers every year from the NCAA participation data overall. But what's happened is that we've got over, and I should be careful here in Aggie country talking about football, but we've basically increased participation opportunities since 1982 in football by over 25,000.
Wow.
So certain sports, baseball, sure. 13,000. And these are great sports, but what they've done is at the expense of gymnastics, wrestling, swimming, right. some teams overall have been cut. And so the interesting thing to look at, is what the data is when schools cut programs under the auspices of Title IX to say they need to save money. We often see that money funneled back into other sports programs. Mm-hmm. It's choices by administrators and not so much Title IX when you really look at the numbers and look at the data.
It's just Title IX is used as a big boogeyman sometimes.
It is. Yeah. You know, a number of years ago at Mount Holyoke, I had to cut – we had 15 sports. I had to cut softball due to – I had to cut a sport. We had budget cuts. Budgets were tight. We'd cut budgets over time. And, you know, you bleed so long and then you have to cut off an arm. And I had to look at it. We used a number of factors. And, you know, it would have been easier to say, oh, this is Title IX. Well, certainly at our school it wasn't. It was a budget. It was a budget decision that we had to make, and it was a hard one. But we weren't able to, you know, raise the flag of Title IX and say that overall.
Yeah. For years I was at a university where the athletic director, it was Division I university where the athletic director was a woman named Judy Rose. And I don't
yes,
know if you know Judy.
I do.
Great athletic director. And they didn't have football there, and they've recently instituted football. And I know one of the things they've looked at it as is an opportunity to increase the number of participants in the women's side as well, because they're adding some women's sports to offset the huge number that you have with football. So with that logic, if you have football, is that a way to actually increase the number of women's sports?
When you look at compliance with Title IX, you've got the three-part test, you know.
Sure.
And the first prong is looking at participation opportunities, how they reflect the undergraduate population. Mm-hmm. And many people have said, people who are anti-Title IX have said, oh, that's the quota system and that's the only way to, that's the only safe harbor. It's really not true, because there are two other ways that schools can show, you know, that they have met compliance. And one is through a history of expanding programs. And the third prong is showing that you've completely met the interest of the undergraduate population. If you're going to look at participation opportunities, I mean, it is a way for women's sports to increase numbers. What's happened, though, Tim, is 15 years ago, the undergraduate population for males and females, men were about 57% of the population, women were 43%. That's completely flipped today.
It has, yeah.
So, and what many people say is that, you know, this is not a fair, the prong one is not a fair way to look at fair and compliance with Title IX. But what people don't realize is it wasn't women advocates years ago who developed the three-part test. In fact, prong one was developed by really male athletic directors and football coaches who at the time, women said when Title IX was implemented, you give us 50% of the budget and we'll give you 50% of the budget. He said, no, that won't work. So they looked at undergraduate students, and at that time men were favored. So the women said, hey, we're going to get more than we got anyway, so let's move forward with the programs. But now that is completely switched. And so it's presenting challenges for schools overall, only if they use that prong. But what's interesting is that the majority of schools who do meet compliance with Title IX typically use prong three to show that they have met the interest on campus overall.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's interesting political issue to some extent, and it kind of gets us away from this idea about the reason we did it in the first place. The reason it was done in the first place was to increase opportunities for female athletes that want to play.
Well, my concern, to be honest, is that as we move forward, you know, I'm a sport educator. I believe in broad-based opportunities for men and women. And as we move forward and put more and more of our resources into just selected sports, you know, we're kind of chasing the golden goose when the majority of you know, we're putting more and more money into football, more and more money into men's basketball, you know, trying to chase that dream of bringing in revenue when only 22 of the top Division I programs, you know, make more than they spend overall.
Yeah.
And in fact, schools, I think in 2012, it said schools on average, public universities subsidize their intercollegiate athletic programs to the tune of $11.5 million a year.
Wow.
So, I mean, I think what I worry about is the sports that are being cut, because not every young man is meant to play football or men's basketball. You know, we've got wrestlers, we've got swimmers, we've got track and, you know, runners. And so if we believe as part of the academy that sport is an educational opportunity, we're really chasing the entertainment piece when we cut out opportunities. So I support broad-based opportunities for men and women, really.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, but along that lines, there's so many things we could talk about here. But one of the things that we've asked previous guests is, then why have collegiate sports at all? Why not just have intramurals and be done with it?
Well, I think there's real value in intercollegiate athletics overall. I think the opportunities, you know, the competition, the life skills that are learned overall, I think are really critical. Mm-hmm. Now, can you learn those through intramurals, club sports? I think in some ways you can. But I think there's a certain structure. There's a commitment. There's a larger commitment that's made overall. And so I truly believe that there's still a place for intercollegiate sport within higher education. But I do believe, you know, I come from the Division III model overall. Philosophically, it's you know, my job was always to do what was in the best interest of the student athletes. Mm-hmm. And that's how I always approached it. Unfortunately, I think in some schools with the Division I model, you know, I think we have problems from the basic philosophical basis of Division I, that they are supposed to support their programs financially based on the revenue that they bring in. Right. If it's got to be revenue driven, your goals and objectives become focused on filling that stadium.
Yeah.
You know,
getting that
exactly.
Yeah.
It's all about money, and so in some ways that push has, I really think, taken it out of the educational sphere, and I think eventually, I mean, it's why we see many, many problems today overall. Many great things that happen, but I think we've got at the larger levels more problems when we try and relate it and connect it to education than we do at the Division III level overall.
Sure. We've had some conversations here with some of our speakers about how athletics really is the front porch of the university.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way that many people get to know your university.
Mm-hmm.
Without football, would we know about the University of Miami? Or
mm-hmm.
basketball, would we know about Georgetown?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an interesting analogy that people use for the importance of sport.
Right.
Yeah.
No, and I think it's really true overall. And that's great until you get a scandal. You know, it's wonderful. Your front porch
right.
looks good, and it's clean, and it looks
yeah.
nice. It's all painted. But then, you know, you have a scandal, and then it in some ways, it taints it. But unfortunately, I think sport just has this overwhelming sense of kind of a positive approach overall. People sort of look
sure.
past that and you know, look at the institution. And so it does, I think, get the name out there overall
right.
in very, very positive ways.
Well, and you mentioned a while ago the life skills that the student athletes
mm-hmm.
learn. And it's you and I both have been in education for a long time and working in different educational opportunities. And what's interesting to me is that the units, the academic units that get along best, faculty, are usually those that are made up of people that have been brought up through sport.
Mm-hmm.
They're used to being on teams. They're used to working together. They understand it's not all about them. It's about the greater good. And other academic units where that's not the case, you don't see that kind of unity. You see a lot of divisive and fighting. Is that what you kind of observed over the years, or am I completely off base with
well,
that?
Well, I have a sense about academics overall. My biggest worry is that some of the academics in the departments were the people that tried out for the team or were the ones picked last in physical education
mm-hmm.
overall. So
mm-hmm.
they really didn't have those opportunities. So not only have they maybe not had opportunities to develop those skills, but they also are a bit tainted towards it in some ways as well. But, you know, we look at the research, and I know that for women in the top the Fortune 500, the top Fortune 500 companies, the top women executives, 80% report that they have been athletes. And sport
wow.
has played an important part in their lives overall with the ability to teamwork, risk-taking,
mm-hmm.
You know, knowing when you're the lead dog, knowing when you take your supportive role overall. And so it's really helped them in their success overall. So I really think that there are skills overall that carry over and can help people to be successful in life. I also believe, Tim, that if a coach doesn't approach it, or a program doesn't approach it from trying to develop positive life skills, you know, we say sport develops character.
Mm-hmm.
We can also develop characters. And we pamper these athletes,
yes.
if they're treated in ways that they can do no wrong, that we pass them through school, we maintain their eligibility, we're giving them the wrong message, and we end up with prima donnas too. So I think that it doesn't automatically happen when you're an athlete. I think it's got to be, you know, we talked about our athletic curriculum. What do we try and do at Mount Holyoke? What do we try and do to help develop these life skills? What opportunities do we give our students? You know, leadership doesn't just happen because you're on a team.
Right.
You've got to been given leadership opportunities and clear expectations on how you grow and develop in those roles overall. And so I think it's got to be thought out. It doesn't just happen automatically.
Right. And they have to have responsibility. We had Adam Sargent, who's an academic advisor at Notre Dame. He's one of the academic advisors for football. He said our biggest difference is we hold them all accountable.
Mm-hmm.
They're all responsible for their actions, and they know that if they mess up, then they're going to be held accountable.
Right.
And they've had some big profile cases in the last year where that's been the case.
Yep.
So it's, and that's, that was his point to our audience here, was that too often our athletics departments don't do that. They don't. They make excuses. They, oh, they're a great athlete. We'll let them slide this time.
And
unfortunately, most of those, many of those kids have been allowed to do that all their life to this point.
Well, I agree. I agree. Yeah. It's one of my concerns when I deal with parents and everything else, the consequences. You know, we don't always have consequences, and it's better to have those consequences when they're younger than wait for the big one later on.
Sure.
You know.
For the last few minutes we have, I want to switch gears just a little bit, because this is really interesting, at least to me anyway. I think it'll be to everyone else. You have several courses that you have taught in the past and continue to teach, and as you said, it's kind of the added benefit of your job. Let's put it that way. One of them is dog sledding.
Yes.
That is unique. In all my years, I haven't heard of a course in dog sledding. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because we've actually we've interviewed some physiologists that do dog sled work.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
I'd love to meet them.
Yeah.
For 8 years, I did teach a dog sledding class. It was interesting. I was on sabbatical in 2003, and my partner and I went cross-country in a motorhome with our kayaks and our hiking boots and our two labs, went up to Alaska, and I love dogs more than people. Mm. So we visited a number of kennels up there, but it was summertime.
Mm-hmm.
Not thinking I was going to teach this class at all, but I always wanted a dog sled. And when I came back, I took a long weekend, and I went dog sledding up in upstate New York, because I just said, you know, I wanted to do it. It was on my bucket list, and I loved it. And then I thought, you know what? I'd love to share this with my students.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what I did was I got in contact in northern Maine with a musher, a woman and her husband, who have over 60 dogs, and they do dog sledding trips. And I worked out a way that I could take 10 students, and my class was always full. It was a January term course. And we would drive up to Maine, and basically we would dog sled for 4 days and winter camp. Polly had a camp on Lake Umbagog up there, and with the canvas tents, we would sleep out on pine boughs in double sleeping bags, and our water bottles would freeze, and we would pull water out of the lake and make our meals and everything else. And it was a great experience for the students. They absolutely loved it. I'll never forget one day a student came in on a dog sled, and she had tears in her eyes. And I said, Gigi, I said, are you having a good day? She goes, no, I'm having the best day of my life.
Wow.
So it really opened them up to the outdoors and gave them an opportunity. Most students love dogs to do this as well, but they got to care for the dogs, learn from Polly, who was great, and it was really, really great. I loved it. Even the morning we woke up and it was minus 17. I loved it.
And isn't that what education is about? It's about exposing people to new opportunities and showing them new things.
I still get notes from those students, and they, you know, when it gets really cold or they get a big snowstorm, they'll send me an email and just say, I'm thinking about you and when we did such and such. So it's heartwarming and really great.
Oh, that's neat. Well, Laurie, thank you so much for being with us today. I've really enjoyed chatting with you. But as we do at the end of every podcast, we ask our guests to give us their take-home message. So do you have a take-home message, the one thing that you want, if people remember nothing else, the one thing they remember from this podcast?
Well, you know what? I think today I'm giving a little presentation here, and one of the things I'm ending with a quote from James Baldwin, who's a novelist, playwright, poet, and social activist. And what I'd like to leave with people is his quote, "Not everything is faced that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced."
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Tim.
Oh, well, you're more than welcome, Laurie. It's been great to have you here. And for regular listeners of our podcast, you know that this is the time of the podcast that we always have our podcast question. And here with the podcast question of the week is our producer, Cheryl.
What was the NCAA takeover?
Great podcast question. Be the first one to send us the answer to that via email at huffinespodcast@hokn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of our nifty podcast t-shirts. So until next week, when we have another interesting person in the world of sports medicine, human performance, physical education, and health, and this is Tim Lightfoot signing off, and we hope that you have an active and healthy week.
Thanks for listening to the Huff Fiennes Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huff Fiennes family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, and our music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffvinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.